Welcome back to TRX. I wanted to, in this segment, welcome a very special guest, a friend of the 10th Amendment Center and of myself personally, Mr. Gary Marbit. Gary is the president of the Montana Shooting Sports Association and the original author of a very important piece of state legislation that we've been tracking for a few years now here at the 10th Amendment Center. And if you want to track, just go to 10thamendmentcenter.com, and near the top left of the page, you'll see a big button that says Legislative Tracking. The bill we're talking about today is the Firearms Freedom Act. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and greetings to your listeners.
Awesome. So, Gary, firearms, I guess first, let's get into this important thing. Firearms, is it just about shooting sports or something bigger?
Well, the Montana Firearms Freedom Act uses firearms as the vehicle for the exercise, but it's really about states' rights and trying to breathe some life back into the 10th Amendment. What it does is it declares that any firearms made and retained in Montana are just not subject to any federal authority whatsoever under the guise of Congress's power to regulate commerce among the states. That is the Commerce Clause. And we say if they stay in Montana, if they're made in Montana, stay in Montana, hands off, feds, it's not your business.
Sounds like a pretty straightforward concept. And I know that the precedent that the federal government has been using on the other side of the spectrum, which is if it's made in Montana and stays in Montana, they're going to get their dirty little hands all over it, has been around for a long, long time. The Wall Street Journal, I saw a few weeks back, did a nice story, at least what I would think a relatively fair story on the progress and the work that you've been doing on the Firearms Freedom Act. The article is called A Gun Activist Takes Aim at U.S. Regulatory Power. And just like you were saying, it said in the article, it said, quote, Mr. Marbit isn't basing his pro-gun effort on the Second Amendment, the one that talks about the right to bear arms, but on the 10th, which discusses the limits of federal power. Can you tell us a little bit more about what they were talking about in that that journal article?
Certainly. You and your listeners, I assume, know that the 10th Amendment says that all power is not granted to the federal government in the underlying Constitution are reserved to the people, to the states and the people thereof, respectively. Well, that's not what the federal government has been acting like for the last 50 years. Starting with the Wickard decision back in, I think, 1942, the Supreme Court determined that anything that has any indirect effect on any kind of commerce whatsoever can be regulated by the federal government under the guise of regulating commerce among the states. I'll come back to the 10th Amendment in a moment, but in order to come up with that definition, that decision, they had to entirely change the definition of three important words in the English language. Hmm. Regulate, which always used to make regular, and had to become prohibit. Commerce, which had always been gross trade and had to become any kind of economic activity, no matter how small. And among, which always used to be with others, and they had to reinterpret that word or redefine that word to mean within. So by doing that, they were able to regulate all kinds of things internal to states that one would think the 10th Amendment would prohibit. So in this lawsuit, which is now before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, we are making some novel and fresh arguments about the Commerce Clause that have never been made before. And I'll give you one sample, and you will like it. We say there's an ancient principle of law that says that if there's a conflict between two provisions in a coequal body of law, the most recently enacted must be given deference as the most recent expression of the enacting authority. Without that principle in place, you could not amend any law. The first time it was passed, it would be that way forever. We say that the 10th Amendment was enacted by the people after the underlying Constitution, including the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause and the Supremacy Clause. And so if there's any conflict between the 10th Amendment and the Commerce Clause, the Commerce Clause must yield to the 10th Amendment as the most recent expression of the enacting authority. By making that argument and other arguments, we hope to resuscitate the 10th Amendment and breathe some life back into it that the courts pretty much have not recognized for maybe a century.
Gary, for people that don't really know a lot about it, I've talked about it quite a bit, and I know you talk and write about it. Tell us a little bit more. Give us the elevator speech on what that 1940s case, I think it was 42, the Wickard versus Filburn case. And then more recently, the related case would be 2005, Gonzalez versus Raich. Give us a little overview of what those two cases are, what they did, and how they relate to what you're working on.
Certainly. In the Wickard case, FDR had been trying to ram through a bunch of power to federal government programs in order to deal with the Depression. Turns out historians think he made things worse rather than fixing them. But he did want to move more power to the federal government. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court had not been going along with him and had been striking down some of his programs because they said, you just don't have the authority in the Constitution to do this stuff, even though he had the majorities in Congress necessary to get the laws passed. One of those was the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which was an attempt to support wheat prices by instituting quotas for farmers to grow wheat and saying that states could only grow so much wheat, and individual counties within states could only grow so much wheat, and individual farms within counties could only grow so much wheat. Well, Mr. Wickard was a farmer, and he grew his quota of wheat, plus he grew some more to feed to his livestock on the farm and to give to his wife to bake bread for the family. And he got fined for growing wheat in excess of his quota, and he sued and went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Meanwhile, FDR had been very frustrated with the Supreme Court. They'd been striking down his programs. So he threatened to do what's called court packing, to expand the number of justices on the Supreme Court from 9 to 15 in order to put a bunch of his cronies on the court who would rubber stamp his programs. Well, under the threat of that court packing, the Supreme Court changed its course with the Wickard decision. And they had to come up with some fancy rationale, as I mentioned, about changing the definition of words in order to do that. But they said what Wickard had done, if every farmer did it, it would have an effect on interstate commerce, even though an indirect effect, it would have some sort of effect on interstate commerce. So therefore, the federal government could prohibit growing his excess wheat as a part of its enumerated power to regulate commerce among the states. So fast forward to the Raich decision, that originated in California with the Compassionate Use Act that California passed by initiative, allowing the medicinal distribution and use of medical marijuana. Meanwhile, even though the state had approved it under state law, the federal government continued to bust medical marijuana clinics, and Raich sued, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was, again, a Commerce Clause exercise. And the question is, does the federal government have Commerce Clause power sufficient to prohibit the distribution of medicinal marijuana in California? What the Supreme Court reasoned, and these reasons grow increasingly strained, they said that because the marijuana grown and distributed for medicinal use in California was indistinguishable from marijuana transported illegally across the state lines and imported illegally, therefore, the medical marijuana was obviously displacing some of this illegal marijuana that was being transported in interstate commerce, even if it was illegal commerce. And so they said, yes, it is affecting some kind of marketplace out there, and therefore, the federal government has the power under the Commerce Clause to prohibit what the people of California had approved on initiative, that is the Compassionate Use Act.
Man, now listeners, this is Gary went over a lot of info there, but there's two really important things that I really wanted to kind of hammer home. One, the absurdity of the idea that the federal government would make trade in a particular product, whatever it may be. It could be marijuana, but it could be radishes, or it could be a gun. They're going to make that trade illegal, but then they're still going to use the rationale that affecting that trade is somehow bad, and they've got to regulate it to make sure that that trade is still regular under their power to regulate commerce. And then the other thing is how back in 42, just through a simple Supreme Court ruling, they shifted the idea of regulating commerce, making commerce regular among or across state borders, into taking control, banning, prohibiting, putting additional regulations on any type of activity that may affect commerce. Now, Gary, like you were saying, the Firearms Freedom Act, this is firearms as a vehicle, but really to reestablish the founders' vision of what the Commerce Clause is. This has been passed in a number of states. Do you know offhand how many there are right now?
Yes. Let me give you a little more history of it.
Okay.
I wrote it in 2004. We had it before the legislature in 2005, 2007, didn't get it passed. We did get it passed in 2009. shortly after that, it was cloned and introduced in many other states. Seven states have actually enacted clone versions of the Montana Firearms Freedom Act in their states, and 20-some other states have introduced the bills that haven't passed yet. So it's a popular idea. And one of the consequences of that is that in our lawsuit, we have a number of attorneys general who have filed amicus brief in support of our lawsuit, both in district court and before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
From at least from what I saw on our tracking, I try to keep an eye on that as much as possible. Most of the states appear to be out west. I know there's Wyoming and Utah and Arizona. Do you think it's maybe because it's kind of closer to home where the original bill passed, or do you think there's more of a just a view that this is a kind of a western U.S. type of concept that's pushed back against Washington, D.C., and those states closer to D.C. are just kind of more in line? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, we have information about the Firearms Freedom Act movement at firearmsfreedomact.com, mm-hmm. and we're trying to keep that updated. And the first thing you see on the front page is a map of the states that have passed Firearms Freedom Acts, that have introduced Firearms Freedom Acts, and or that have done nothing. But there are quite a few states east of the Mississippi that have introduced bills, and Tennessee did pass one. I think Tennessee was the second. I mean, the first
right.
one after Montana. So I admit that more western states have passed it than eastern states, but I wouldn't say that there's no interest in the eastern states, especially the smaller ones and the less urban ones.
Oh, okay, so there's still a number of people out east that are... So the East Coast isn't totally lost yet, I guess. That's the question.
Correct, and I see this divide, you know, about federal power as being more an urban-rural divide than a east-west divide. And certainly the urban areas tend to get more benefit from federal power and federal taxation and federal spending than do the rural areas, and rural people tend to be a little more independent.
So the Wall Street Journal, they reported on this, I'm assuming because there's something happening. I mean, I try to keep up on the winding through the court system, but where are you guys at right now on the suit? Is there something coming up that we all need to be aware of, or how are things standing?
The District Court of Montana dismissed the suit based on standing, merit, and jurisdiction. We expected that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court. We filed our briefs in support of the appeal. All of our amicus friends filed their briefs. The United States Attorney General Eric Holder filed his brief in opposition. And then we filed our reply brief to his response brief. And now the Ninth Circuit will appoint a 3-judge panel to take charge of this appeal. They will probably, almost certainly, order oral argument, probably in Seattle, maybe in Portland. That will probably happen within the next couple of months. And then it'll take them a while to decide, to make the decision. And we're not counting on the theory that the decision is going to go in our favor, even though mm-hmm. we've made what we think are some very compelling arguments,
mm-hmm.
which is fine, because we understand that only the United States Supreme Court can give us the relief that we ask for, and
right.
that is essentially to reverse a half century of bad Commerce Clause precedent and all of its progeny.
We had a question from, it just kind of maybe changed directions for just a moment, a question posted by Zach on our Facebook page, and any of you listeners have questions about for future guests, just go to facebook.com/10thAmendmentCenter and just post away. We'll try to grab some as we can. But here's what Zach has to say, quote, "I feel that this bill may have problems with the substantial effects test set up by the court to determine whether the federal government may control guns. U.S. versus Lopez has largely been rolled back, I'm sorry to say." Now, I don't really know a lot about the substantial effects test, but do you have any insight on that, Gary?
Yes, right. The substantial effects test is part of the progeny of Wickard that we want to see the Supreme Court overturn.
Mm.
Now, in the recent year or so ago Citizens United decision about corporate spending for elections, Chief Justice Roberts wroote the decision, and he said, you know, stare decisis, trying to stick with precedent, is a good idea until our precedent gets so jury-rigged that they no longer make any sense at all, in which case then it's time to forget stare decisis and revise the precedent. Gosh, that's what we're talking about here. I've never seen anything so jury-rigged and cobbled together with duct tape and baling wire as Commerce Clause jurisprudence. And so I think, especially given the recent Bond decision, which you must read if you haven't, I think the Supreme Court is in a mood to give serious consideration to what we ask.
Well, I think at a worst-case scenario, they are in a mood. They're actually more than I've ever seen, and I mean, I'm not ancient in this activism gig, but more than I've seen in my study as well, they are actually considering the founder's view rather than only precedent. So that, I think, gives us a little bit of hope. So you say that there's possibly another phase in the courts over the next 1 to 2 months. How many more steps before it would actually get to the Supreme Court, Gary?
Well, after the Ninth Circuit rules, if they rule against us, then we will be able to apply for certiorari or apply to be heard before the United States Supreme Court. If the Ninth Circuit rules in our favor, you can absolutely bet that the Attorney General is going to appeal to the United States Supreme Court. So I see it going to the Supreme Court no matter what. But that'll have to wait until the Ninth Circuit has issued its ruling, and that'll probably be some guesswork involved, but next spring sometime, maybe late winter.
Now, I know I don't want to distract you from all the good work you're doing, and what I think is great about the court case is it's bringing more and more mainstream attention. This is going to take a long time to educate people on the proper role of the government, how the Commerce Clause is supposed to be read, and this is getting the discussion out there. I know you've got a backup plan, Gary. I'm sure you got something. So let's say you get all the way to the court, the Supreme Court, as you need to. What's the backup plan if they don't do what they're supposed to do?
Well, we have several backup plans. I guess I shouldn't talk for tactical reasons, shouldn't talk about all of them. But
right.
One of them we have talked about a lot, and that's another bill that I wrote that we call Sheriffs First.
Right.
Sheriffs First is a bill to enact a state law to make it a crime for a federal officer to arrest, search, or seize in the county without the advance written permission of the elected county sheriff. The sheriffs are supposed to be the chief law enforcement officer in the county, and they have local knowledge and local information about what's going on. And so how that would work is in a state that passed Sheriffs First, by the way, I have that posted at sheriffsfirst.net if anybody's interested, how that would work in a state that enacted it is suppose the DEA comes to the sheriff and says, here's our probable cause to lead us to believe that this person at this address in your county has a meth lab, and we want to go bust him. And the sheriff might say, gosh, I think that's a great idea. I'm glad you brought it to my attention. Here's your signed written permission, and I'm sending two deputies with you both to help you out and to make sure that no county residents' rights get trampled. Or it might be the BATF who comes to the sheriff and says, here's our probable cause to lead us to believe that this person at this address in your county is manufacturing firearms without a federal license, and we want to go bust them. And the sheriff might say, sorry, no, our state has a Firearms Freedom Act in place, and that allows what they're doing, and you do not have my permission to go bust them. And if you do, you commit a crime in Montana, and you can be put in the Montana State Prison for that.
Gary, we just have just another minute here before we have to go. Tell us again a little bit about where people can kind of keep in tune with the work you're doing, maybe a quick overview of the Shooting Sports Association, and then we'll have to run.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, your readers should really go to the Wall Street Journal and look up that story about the Firearms Freedom Act. The easiest way to find it on the Wall Street Journal website is simply search for my last name, M-A-R-B-U-T. And that's a good story. We'll explain the whole Firearms Freedom Act business. Then we are trying to keep information fresh, including all the filings in our lawsuit, at firearmsfreedomact.com. So your listeners could visit there. Finally, Montana Shooting Sports Association has a website at mtssa.org. MTSSA.org for the Montana Shooting Sports Association, and about a fifth of our members do not reside in Montana. They're people who just like what we're doing and want to support us, want to be a part of our successes, and so we're always looking for members, and we'd be glad to have any of your members join the Montana Shooting Sports Association, again at MTSSA.org.
Absolutely fantastic, Gary. Can't thank you enough for spending a few minutes with us today. This is TRX 10th Radio. In just a couple of minutes after the break, state-level resistance to No Child Left Behind. That's really good stuff. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.